From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
Welcome to Issues in the News. I'm Barbara Slavin, Acting Director of the Future of Iran Initiative at the Atlantic Council and Washington correspondent for Al Monitor. Joining me on the show this week are Tom DeFrank, Contributing Editor to the National Journal, and Abdurrahim Fukara, Washington Bureau Chief for Al Jazeera Satellite TV. And here are the issues. Turkey's president declared a three-month state of emergency following a coup attempt. This will give him extraordinary new dictatorial powers. The move includes a massive crackdown on alleged opponents of the president in the military and civil service, and rising fears of continued instability in a key NATO ally and frontline state against ISIS. Donald Trump accepted the Republican nomination for president after an uneven and at times raucous convention. The focus of Trump supporters was less praise for their man than hatred of Hillary Clinton, the soon-to-be Democratic nominee. Well, gentlemen, we have two huge stories to discuss this week. And Abdurrahim, let's start with Turkey. There was an attempted coup. It was squelched, but the crackdown that has followed is in some ways more alarming than the coup attempt itself. What has been going on in Turkey?
Well, actually, I find both of them alarming. The fact that the coup happened in the first place, it signals that Erdogan's position has been much more tenuous than many people, including himself, had led us to believe. And that obviously has serious repercussions for the future of Turkey in terms of its stability and the stability of its institutions. Now, he has this state of emergency declared, voted by a majority of parliament, for sure. But there are also opposition parties who are now having serious reservations about it, and they think that it will give dictatorial powers to Erdogan.
It's passed the parliament, though, I believe.
It passed the parliament, and some of his people, Erdogan's people, are saying at the end of the day, we may not take it the full 3 months that was approved by parliament. But there are others who think that it may even be taken beyond the 3 months mandated by parliament. The example of what happened in France when the French parliament authorized the state of emergency after the Paris attacks, and then the French government wanted to extend them. So we'll know the full extent of the state of emergency. I have to say, though, that for all the criticism that he's come under, which is totally understandable, and the concerns of the Europeans, especially, I have to say, the Northern Europeans and the Americans. And I say the Northern Europeans because the Northern Europeans have no memory of military coups.
Sure.
The Southern Europeans do, the Portuguese, sure. The Spanish, the Greeks.
Yeah.
And perhaps, if not the governments, perhaps people in those three countries may be a little bit more sympathetic to the position that Erdogan finds himself in today. Sure, the future of democracy in Turkey, everyone needs to worry about it. But I wonder what a French government or a British government, this is a surreal scenario, would do if their countries were rocked by a coup.
Tom, I think one of the most concerning things for Americans besides the question of human rights is the effect on the fight against ISIS, the effect on the Turkish military. Something like a third of Turkey's most important generals have now been purged from the military. I was looking at some statistics about Turkey's military role. It has the second largest military in NATO after the U.S., an estimated force of 411,000. Many of the high-ranking military officers who've now been arrested were leading the operations against ISIS and also against the Kurdish group, the PKK. What is this going to mean for Turkey's involvement in the U.S.-led coalition against ISIS and for the stability of the country as it faces continuing threats from militant Kurds and Islamic fundamentalists?
Turmoil in the short term for sure, Barbara, at least for the next several months. I was flabbergasted to learn that the commander of Turkish operations at the big air base Incirlik, where the United States Air Force has a huge military presence, the Turkish commander asked for political asylum, and he couldn't get it from the United States because he wasn't on U.S. territory. He was on Turkish soil. Well, of course, that was a telltale sign. He was promptly arrested. But the point is, this was the general whose base was central to the anti-terror operation in Turkey. on behalf of NATO. So I think the instability is very serious. Now, even if you assume that Erdogan doesn't want to be dictator for life, if he can consolidate his authority without becoming an out-and-out dictatorial presence, I think it'll get back to normal in the terror fight because, as we all know, Turkey has such a problem with terror. They've got this long border with Syria. So many of the jihadists fighting in the United States, having been trained in this area, have passed through Syria. Many of these terrorists, including some so-called lone wolves in the United States, have Turkish stamps on their passports. And so Turkey is critical, not just for NATO generically, but for the fight on terror. And so this can't be good, at least in the short run.
Abdurrahim, in the aftermath of the coup attempt, a number of pro-Erdogan newspapers blamed the United States. And they point the finger at the U.S. because Fethullah Gulen, erstwhile friend, now foe of Erdogan, lives in Pennsylvania. Is there any proof so far that he really directed this coup attempt? And perhaps tell us a little bit about him and about his former alliance with Erdogan, because the two of them together conspired to purge the military back starting in 2007.
This particular point in time, there's absolutely not a shred of evidence that the United States was involved. The time that the Obama administration, both the White House and the State Department, took in clear terms react to what happened the night of the coup obviously raises questions and it raises reservations, all sorts.
I think people didn't know what was happening for several hours.
Yeah, I understand the position of the Obama administration. They wanted to be absolutely sure what was going on. But in the eyes of people in Turkey and the region at large, they look at it through a different prism. Why did the Obama administration wait until it was absolutely sure that Erdogan had actually survived? What did it mean? Did it mean that they were biding their time? If the military had won, they would have supported the military. The issue now is, what will the whole shenanigans about Fethullah Gulen, what will it mean for relations between the United States and Turkey? I mean, when you hear Erdogan saying Fethullah Erdogan is a terrorist, and incidentally, Fethullah Gulen has categorically not just condemned the coup, he's denied any involvement in it. But when you have Erdogan saying Fethullah Gulen is a terrorist, and every time the United States have asked us to hand over a terrorist to them, we did it, that means that now we're telling them that Fethullah Gulen, who is a resident of Pennsylvania, USA, that he is a terrorist, the US must give us Fethullah Gulen. The administration is saying, we'll look at the evidence once they've formally given us an extradition request. If it's legally and judicially safe, we'll look at the issue of extradition. There's no evidence that the U.S. is involved in the coup, except that Gulen is here, and Gulen is a very, very powerful guy. He's powerful not just in terms of political and ideological and cultural influence. He has hundreds of schools, a network of schools, both in Turkey and here in the United States.
And around the world.
Yeah. He has a lot of money. And he has a lot of political influence inside Turkey. He has followers among judges. He has followers among the police force in Turkey. So all this is adding up to the perception, which obviously Erdogan is playing to his advantage, that the U.S. may have something to do with the coup directly or indirectly. What people find very difficult to understand is that in the US, you cannot issue a political decree saying Gulen has to leave, even though he's not an American citizen. He has a green card, but you cannot say
we
this
have judicial
person,
processes it that he has to go through. Process. We're going to turn pretty soon to our own political situation, Tom, but I want to go back again to this question of how does the U.S. operate this war on ISIS if Turkey is not a reliable ally? The Turkish authorities stopped flights out of Incirlik Air Base. They turned off the power, at least for several days. I'm not sure that it's back on again. I think they were still using generators. I've seen commentary suggesting that the United States can manage without Incirlik because there are other places in northern Iraq and so on in Jordan where the U.S. can fly these missions from. But in terms of closing what's called the Manbij pocket, this chunk of territory, I think it's 68 kilometers on the border between Turkey and Syria, where it's been a lifeline for ISIS and so on, without the Turkish army on that border, can the U.S. actually close that pocket and really starve ISIS of support.
It would be very difficult, Barbara, for that to happen without the long-term presence of Incirlik. The U.S. has had a significant military air presence in Incirlik for 40 years. A lot of other things are done out of there, refueling.
There are nuclear weapons there, too,
right
there.
Exactly right. I'm just guessing that once Erdogan, who seems to be increasingly paranoid about his situation, once he feels a little less paranoid, once he decides that he is back in control, however you define that, I think things will revert to normal, more or less, vis-a-vis the United States. But I agree with Abdi that Gulen will be a continuing irritant, because I think there's virtually no chance that he will be extradited, and that could really change the equation. Of course, let's not forget, President Obama now has less than 6 months in office. Erdogan might decide, well, I can revisit this with the next president, and if the next president is Donald Trump, whose probably philosophy is closer to mine, I might get a better arrangement there. So I think we're probably going to have a few rocky months here, but things will ultimately revert to a semblance of status quo vis-a-vis the U.S. and Turkey.
One quick irony is that 5 years ago, it was Erdogan, Obama, Cameron against Bashar al-Assad. Bashar al-Assad is still in power. Mm. Obama will be leaving in 6 months. Cameron is gone.
Yeah.
And Erdogan almost went. We don't know if he'll be around in 6 months.
Well, on that note, we'll have more in just a minute. First, a reminder that you're listening to Issues in the News coming to you on the Voice of America in Washington. I'm your moderator, Barbara Slavin of Al-Monitor, and joining me today are Tom DeFrank of National Journal and Abdurrahim Fukara of Al Jazeera. And this is a reminder that you can listen to Issues online as a podcast. The program is also available for free download on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/issues. We're going to turn now to our other major topic, and it is a huge one. Tom, I'm going to start with you. It was an interesting convention, I guess, is one way to put it. Donald Trump has accepted the Republican nomination to be president. He gave a interesting acceptance speech. But I wanted you, from your vantage point as someone who's covered a number of these conventions, just to give your impressions of how it was managed. Trump had promised it was going to be like nothing we had seen before. It was going to be a sort of extravaganza full of celebrities and sports stars and very entertaining. What do you think?
Well, it was fairly entertaining, Barbara, but not in the ways that I think Mr. Trump was hoping for. There was controversy after controversy, the first being on day one, where his wife Melania did a very good speech praising her husband, that it turned out significant portions of which were excerpted from a speech that Michelle Obama made in 2008, just lifted word for word. I mean, there was no doubt that it was wholesale plagiarism. And so that's the sort of thing political experts call stepping on the message. A very good speech was obscured by the fact that clearly it was lifted, and the Trump campaign kept coming up with competing explanations. No, it was all her work. And then it was, well, she wrote most of it with a little bit of help. And finally, they had to fess up that
that's true, we still don't know.
Right. What they admitted was that a speechwriter for Trump who'd worked for him for years had taken some phrases that she'd gotten from Melania Trump, who admires Michelle Obama, who probably sent a lot of Trump people through the ceiling. Anyway, that just distracted from the message of the convention. And then on day three, you had Senator Ted Cruz of Texas, who had more delegates committed to him than anyone except Donald Trump, in exchange for a primetime speaking slot, refused to endorse Trump and was booed off the stage at the end of his speech. Clearly, Senator Cruz is gambling that Donald Trump is not going to just lose. He's going to lose decisively, in which case he can pick up the pieces. So all of these things distracted from the fact that I think Donald Trump did what he needed to do. He needed to pretty much pull the party together. He needed to strike conservative Republican themes, and he did that. His speech was interesting, if interminable. An hour and 15 minutes is really, really long. But he basically, I think, appealed to classic Republican voters and was hoping, by emphasizing trade and jobs, that he could get some so-called Reagan Democrats, blue-collar Democrats in places like Ohio and Pennsylvania, where jobs have been exported overseas, to come his way. So in the strategic sense, I think he was successful. The real question is going to be whether his speech appeals to a broader potential constituency. This was a very dark speech. The theme of this was, people are safe. They're nervous in their homes. They're nervous in the streets. Police officers are being killed by African Americans, angry that police are killing African-Americans with some apparent provocation, and he just listed a whole string of terror events from San Bernardino to Orlando, all over the place, and he basically said, I am your voice and I will protect you. Whatever else it was, and I think his message was executed pretty well. That is not a visionary message, and I think Hillary Clinton in the coming days in Philadelphia, the Democratic Convention, is going to say, here's my vision of the future.
Right.
We are not a country in trouble. We have problems, but here's what I want to do to make America better. We are great already. Trump is saying, we used to be great.
Yeah.
We're not great anymore. Hillary's going to say, we are great, and here's how we'll be greater. And we'll just have to see in the fall which of those two messages resonates.
Yeah. Abdurrahim, another element of this convention was a kind of relentless negativity, I mean, about Hillary Clinton. Now, you expect, obviously, that your opponent will be criticized, but some of the things that were said about her, particularly one of the lines that was chanted over and over at this convention was, lock her up, lock her up. I don't know that I've ever heard that kind of language used. Ben Carson, a failed Republican candidate, almost basically compared her to Satan at one point.
And
I wanted to give you a chance. I mean, as somebody as observing this, not part of the American political scene, I just wanted to get a sense of how that struck you.
Yeah, I mean, it was very striking, and it was a continuation of this line about the anger that's percolating, not just the electorate, various parts of the country. For me, it circled me back to that moment several years ago when Obama was giving an address, I think it was the State of the Union address in Congress, and one of the Republicans said, you lie!
Yeah.
And, you know, to me, those two moments are certainly joinable through the negative things that he's been saying about not just Hillary Clinton, but Hillary Clinton being a continuation of Barack Obama, whether in terms of domestic politics or in terms of foreign policy, all the mess in the Middle East, he keeps saying Hillary is responsible for it,
right,
because
right.
She was Secretary of State for Obama in his first term. I was there briefly one night, and to me, there was inside the convention and there was outside the convention. I mean, the level of anger that people were seriously worried about outside the convention did not come to pass.
There were protests, though.
There were protests, mm-hmm. but the kind of anger and clashes, Tom earlier mentioned the police and the African Americans, mm-hmm. the kind of real trouble that was going to be a spoiler to the Trump party and message did not happen. In many ways, that's a credit to the city of Cleveland and mm-hmm. the measures that he took. But inside the convention, I walked on the floor. I have to say, it was quite infectious. The atmosphere was quite infectious, the music, the entertainment, and all that. And it seems to me that at least inside the convention, all this dark speech that Tom mentioned about inside the convention, it did resonate with people inside the convention. Mm-hmm. To what extent it's going to resonate outside the convention, I don't know. Incidentally, I wasn't here in the 70s, but my understanding was that when Reagan ran against Carter, Carter had depicted a bleak picture for the future of the U.S. Reagan came and said, no, America's better days are ahead. That resonated with the electorate, and it had the result that we all know. Carter lost, Reagan won.
Yeah, of course, Reagan had a very, very different personality, and also, I must say, as a former actor, a speaking ability that Donald Trump lacks. He read his speech. He read it in the same sort of high level of tone, a kind of yelling tone from beginning to end, which is an endurance feat for an hour and 15 minutes. Tom, a lot of the commentators afterwards were saying they were looking for something to humanize him a bit, to turn him from a somewhat cartoonish figure into someone who more people could relate to. And they talked about previous speeches by previous nominees where people talked about humble beginnings and so on. And then it occurred to me, Trump, of course, doesn't have a humble beginning. He doesn't have a rags-to-riches story that he can share
because he
was born rich and was a rich man's son and had all the privileges that went with that. So maybe people were expecting too much, but clearly he could have talked about bankruptcies or struggles in his marriages or something that would have made him seem more human. And even his children, who otherwise were rather admirable, did not really fill in a picture of a whole man.
Trump is a riches-to-riches story. There was only one instance where he had an element of humanity there. There's been a lot of stories written about Trump's philandering in days past. And at one point, he said he was very grateful for the strong support he has gotten from the evangelical Christian community. And he said, and this was clearly an ad lib, I think, mm-hmm. he said, and I'm not sure I deserve that.
Yeah, that's...
That was the closest he came. And also, the other instance was where he talked about how he would fight to defend the rights of LGBTQ. And then he said, and I must tell you, as a Republican, I'm very happy to hear you applaud what I just said. So those were the two elements, but that wasn't a lot in an hour and 15 minutes. I continue to believe that he did what he needed to do, which was to reinvigorate and reenergize the Republican base. The question will become, is that base enough to win in the fall? And I think the jury is still out on that. I think there are not enough members of the traditional Republican base, even if fairly unified now than they were when they arrived at the convention in Cleveland. Are there enough of those to win a general election? In that respect, I think the Trump campaign has got a ways to go.
Yeah. Abduhin, I want to talk about the foreign policy aspects of the Trump message. Before he spoke, he gave an interview to the New York Times, was asked again about things like NATO and our alliances in Asia and so on. And his answers were certainly rather disconcerting if you're an East European who fears a reinvigorated Russia, or you're Japanese or Korean and you fear the North Koreans or you fear the Chinese.
Clearly, what he's been saying about NATO in particular is obviously very unsettling, not just here in the US, but very unsettling to US allies everywhere. Remains to be seen to what extent he will actually do what he's been saying concerning NATO if he becomes the next U.S. president. I mean, even with Barack Obama and certainly previous presidents, we heard them say things before they became president, and then they hit the reality of it once they became president. Mm-hmm. So they obviously started at least tempering those statements. The issue of NATO obviously links up with Turkey. And I found very interesting his take on what's been happening in Turkey. Mm. He's been very moderate and very temperate, if ambiguous, on the issue of the coup attempt in Turkey. So he's not been overly critical of Erdogan. He's not been overly critical of the army. But he's reserved the sharpness of his criticism for the Obama administration, again blaming it for creating the conditions in Turkey and in the Middle East at large that are leading to these situations. And finally, it seems to me that everything that he's been saying about the state of international affairs, it just tells me that the days of globalization as he understands it are over. And there are things that are happening on the ground, such as Brexit, mm-hmm. which are lending support to everything that he's been saying, that he wants to bring back manufacturing to the U.S., he wants to bring back jobs to the U.S. And people may not believe him, but there is certainly stuff happening out there in the world which is flowing against the current of globalization. And I think he seems to be riding that wave. And many people here in the U.S. are responding positively to him on that.
He said about Turkey, our country has a lot of problems, and I think it's very hard for us to get involved in other countries when we don't know what we're doing and we can't see straight in our own country. Tom, we're coming toward the close, but one last point, if I could, from you. He talked a lot about fixing everything that's wrong in the United States. Where's the money going to come from if he's also going to reduce taxes?
Well, at the same time, I should say, Barbara, he has said he's not going to touch the Medicare program, which is health insurance for older Americans, or Social Security, which is the retirement pension plan for older Americans. And those two are among the more significant drivers of the deficit. He railed about the deficit, which he said is now $19 trillion.
That's the national debt.
The national debt. But I'm not sure the numbers add up. He has not explained exactly how he would square that circle. But something's got to give. You can't reduce taxes and keep benefit programs at a high level without something happening.
Okay. That's all the time we have. Joining us today were Tom DeFrank, contributing editor to National Journal, and Abdurrahim Fukara, Washington bureau chief for Al Jazeera. This program was produced by Carol Castiel. Our engineers were Wagner Roberts and Linus Rimkus. I'm Barbara Slavin, acting director of the Future of Iran Initiative at the Atlantic Council and Washington correspondent for Al Monitor. Thanks for listening.
from